Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Runners Connect podcast. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to listen to us. Today on our episode, we have Bob Schwartz, who's the author of two books now, I Run, Therefore I Am Nuts, and I Run, Therefore I Am Still Nuts. I believe he's also the author of a couple other books that he'll tell us about. And if you want to watch this, or if you want to access any of the links on this podcast, you can visit runnersconnect.net/RC10, and that'll get you all the links that we talk about here today in today's interview, and any more information about Bob or contacting either of us. So welcome, Bob. Thank you for having us for today and taking your time out of your day to talk to us.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. I appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. So let's start by introducing yourself to the audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your running background, and again, obviously some of the books that you've written.
Okay. I began running way back when I was about 11 years old at summer camp, and actually started running with the counselors there, and really got into it, ran middle school track and cross country. But then I had to make a decision in high school whether I was going to go basketball or track and field and cross country there, and I went the basketball route. So I played basketball all high school, but also ran. So I was running a lot, ran in local races, ran my first marathon when I was a senior in high school, and then went on to college in Boulder, Colorado. It sounds like from there I went to Eugene, Oregon. So two places that are running meccas in the United States that I think subconsciously was basing some of my decision on where I was going for college and coach as to whether they were built for runners or not, in a good running environment. And they both did. So throughout all that time, I ran and ran races. And then since that time, I've continued to run.
Very cool. And along the way, you wrote a couple books. I know you just published one recently. Tell us a little bit about those two books and, you know, kind of how they came about and, you know, where you, you know, yeah, more specifically how they came about and what they're about.
Sure. The history of the books, way back in most of my marathons were in the 80s and 90s. And I ran the Detroit Free Press Marathon in the late 90s. And had an interesting experience and wrote a funny essay for Michigan Runner magazine, one of the regional running magazines. There's a group of them throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. And from there, you know, I kind of got into the writing the humorous running essays, had a couple published in Runner's World, and eventually started writing for a lot of the regional running publications throughout the country. New York Runner magazine at that time was around, and some various Arkansas Runner, Oklahoma Runner, Run Ohio, and they were all carrying my humorous essays. Mm-hmm. And at that point, this was probably right around the year 2000, I was gathering a list of publishers to contact to see if they would be interested in a humorous running book. And I thought I'd take a shot in the dark at Human Kinetics, who some of your audience may recognize as being a large publisher of running-related books, but mostly training books and serious books mm-hmm. about how to become faster, things along those lines. And they were initially a little hesitant to bite the bullet and offer me a contract to write the book, because they had not done something like that in the past. But they were willing to take a chance, and I appreciate that to this day. But I think we've both been very happy with what happened, which was when the original book came out in 2001, no one really knew whether it would find an audience or just lay there on the shelf or sell well. And I started doing the expo circuit that fall. We're going from Chicago Marathon. I spoke there and sold the book, and New York Marathon, various large races. Mm-hmm. Found an audience really, really quickly. Most runners could relate to the idiosyncrasies that we all possess that were pronounced throughout the book in these humorous essays.
Yeah.
And the title of the book, which was one of the sticking points originally, when the publisher asked me to come up with a title, I had difficulty finding something that they enjoyed. And so they take a slant on the philosophical quote there and call it "I run, therefore I am nuts." And I quite honestly despised that when they first presented it to me. I did not like that title. I thought runners would be offended by it, insensitive. And I couldn't have been completely more wrong, because Chicago Marathon was the first marathon that I worked at with selling the book and speaking. And when people were coming to the expo and seeing the name of the book, nobody had a bad reaction. Everybody was welcome to put themselves within the umbrella of being nuts. And they loved the title. Spouses would say to their with, "Yeah, that's you, dear." And so it worked out well.
Definitely. Yeah, it's funny, you know, actually, it's funny that you mentioned the publisher, Human Kinetics, because that's actually one of the things that I noticed when you sent me a copy of the book. I hadn't noticed that when I read the original book. That was my first thought was, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know Human Kinetics published outside of the more physiology type books. So it's funny that you brought it up. And then also that, you know, the title really, even though it didn't necessarily what you wanted, really ended up working out well, because I think it's true. You make light of it in the humorous essays, but you know, we are kind of nuts for some of the stuff that we do.
We do, and we welcome it.
Exactly. So yeah, let's get a little bit into, and not necessarily the book itself, but you know, some of the principles that you teach in the book, or I shouldn't say teach, but talk about. And one of the reasons that I really enjoyed reading your book, and to mention, I read your first book probably, just as I was graduating high school, maybe I was in college when I read the first book, and I really, really enjoyed it. But one of the things that it actually helped me do is kind of take a lighter approach to my running and my own training. And as a coach, I find that so many athletes take their training too serious, almost to a detriment. You know, I think there needs to be a balance between, you know, working hard and putting in the effort, but also relaxing. And, you know, when you have a bad workout, not letting it, you know, derail your training. Or for example, when I was a freshman or sophomore in college, if I had a bad workout, you know, it ruined my weekend. And I don't think that's a healthy way to approach things. And so that's why I really appreciate, you know, your book. Not only does it have some interesting lessons, but I think it adds some levity, to the whole running process and making sure it's something that continues to be fun. But anyway, kind of, my question for you is, you know, share some of the lessons that you've learned about running, you know, through some of one of my favorite chapters is in the books when you talk about your experience with running injuries. Talk about some of the injuries that you've had and some of the stories that you tell in the book.
Well, I do, especially with the sequel, which I should back up a little bit. It was just about a year, or I should say, over the course of the last few years, the Human Kinetics had requested that I do a sequel, and I really wasn't ready to do one, but ultimately bit the bullet and said I would do it, and I was pleased that it turned out so well. But you'll see within that book, a good portion or a good section of the book deals with inner injuries, because during the time I was writing the book, I had the ultimate injury, which ultimately resulted in knee surgery. I had a meniscus tear that unfortunately went a long time without being diagnosed, but it gives you some sense of perspective. And as you point out, though the book is very, you know, it's designed to be a humorous book with a lot of funny anecdotes and essays, when the first book came out, the reviews that were coming in did also talk about the lessons that are in the book, and that thing people could appreciate some of the things that I was conveying. And to be quite honest, in my mind, I wasn't offering any lessons. But going back and looking at the book and realizing, well, yeah, I guess there are things that people can take away here with some insight on how it can impact their running. And so in this book, yes, injuries are addressed. You know, I was always had the mindset of, as many runners do, that basically if you can run on it, even with pain, it's not an injury. there's part of the chapter, let me see if I can grab a portion of that area in the book now, and just a couple of things that I talked about is the way I phrased it in the book was, if you can walk after a run without dragging a leg and leading others to believe that you're practicing for a role as Igor in Young Frankenstein, where you're really injured. And, you know, we also operate under the philosophy of, you know, if you can complete the first mile of a run without a series of contortionist moves, which make you appear like the halftime performer twist all their body parts enough to get inside a miniature box, then you're not injured if you can get through that. And there's been plenty of times where I've had piriformis injuries or things of that nature. And, you know, you try to run and you're getting down the street and you're trying not to put weight on that side of your body where the injury is. And, you know, it gives you, the appearance of you're contorting your body. But, and I was also, quite honestly, as runners do, utilizing anti-inflammatories and pain relievers and things of that nature to mask the pain. And you finally realize at some point, and it took, I'll be honest, that it took a long period of time for me to arrive at the sparkling conclusion that it doesn't get better by running on it. It just never does. And you're back further. So 2 weeks of trying to plow through an injury may set you back, 2 months of cross training. So I do try to I'm not always the best at taking that advice. And those who may be my age remember a great New Zealand runner by the name of Jack Foster, who was a great runner in his prime, but also as a master's runner was an exceptional runner. And he always had he had very simple philosophies to his running. And one of them was obviously that if it hurts, don't run on it, where most runners' philosophy is if it hurts, you know, just run a little slower or not as far. But you really do set yourself back by trying to run through an injury. One of the lines, there is a chapter in the book that offers some lessons that I've learned through the course of running for 40 odd years. And that is, trying to run through an injury is about as successful as trying to surf through a tsunami. I mean, there's no way about it that you're going to be successful in the end trying to run through an injury. So I did learn ultimately to listen to your body. And I think that's the key that people can, you know, it's not mind-blowing advice there. We all know it. It's just a question of implementing it and having an understanding that you're just simply setting yourself further and further back as you try to work through an injury. And certainly there's dings that you may get that you can run through little pieces of pain that are simply maybe sore muscles or something like that. But you know when you've got an injury that you're going to have to take some time off with.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's such a great lesson. And again, one of the reasons that I appreciate the book is that, you know, sometimes when we do those things, you know, kind of the approach almost to the extent of the title, you know, I run, therefore I'm not. Sometimes when we have injuries, and I know I've done this myself as a runner, is we just think that it's common or that's what everybody does. And it's the right way to do things. And sometimes, you know, I can write, you know, one of the things that I notice is, you know, I can write articles all day long about, you know, the scientific, you know, reasons that, you know, you need to take time off to recover from an injury. Like you talked about, sometimes taking a week or two at the front end of an injury saves you 4 to 6 weeks of cross training down the road. And, you know, we can talk all we want about the science and why that's practical and all that kind of stuff. But I think for a lot of people, what really hits home is when they have a story like yours, or, you know, you can share an experience like you had, and especially in a humorous way. That really kind of, sometimes it's the straw that breaks the camel's back, in the sense of, you know, they hear all this, like, you shouldn't run through injuries, you shouldn't run through injuries. And then they read a humorous story about it and like, oh yeah, that was kind of stupid of me to do, you know, maybe I won't do that next time. So I think that's a good way to open people up to that and at least give them another angle to come at in terms of, you know, maybe some of the better ways to approach their training.
Right, right. No question about it. But also getting back to some of what you were saying at the origin of your question there about when you were in college and may have had a bad workout and how it may impact you for, you know, some time. And that was me to a significant degree with poor race performances or bad training run or something where it just would, you know, you throw yourself a little pity party for a while and you can't get out of it. And as you get older, one thing I've certainly learned, especially coming back from almost missing an entire year of running, being able to cross train, but ultimately almost a whole year, is that you learn a lot about perspective. And there's a line from a book by Richard Bach called Illusions, where he offers the advice of perspective, use it or lose it. And it's very simple, but so true, that you really just have to have perspective on everything. And especially when you're, you know, if you have a bad race that happens, you have a short, short memory with it, because as long as you're accepting the fact that you put forth a good effort, then sometimes the results aren't as you like, but you have to move on. And I think, especially with injuries, you learn perspective, where coming back, when I first began running again, which was in February of this year, you know, I'd been cross-training on an elliptical machine for a long time and was still cardiovascularly pretty solid, but it's obviously much different than putting feet on pavement and running down the road. And so, you know, it's quote unquote a long road back, but it does come back quickly. But you know, as you're coming back, you're not thinking about, well, you know, a year earlier I was running 70-mile weeks. You're thinking, on Monday I ran a mile, on Tuesday I was able to run a mile and a half, and it's perspective, and you're very happy that you're able to run again. So I think I have a healthier approach to my running and racing now, having gone through that process of having a significant injury and missing a great deal of time for running, where now you have a greater appreciation for just the ability to get out the door each day.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I think that can often happen when you go long periods of time where training is going well or things are kind of just smoothly moving along. You do sometimes lose perspective of how nice it is just to be able to run. I went through the same thing myself with a plantar fascia injury, and definitely was a good lesson in perspective. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, you said you came back from that injury in February. You know, how did you find the process to go in terms of, you know, coming back? Did you have a lot of those? Because I didn't really read much in the book about it in terms of, you know, coming back from that injury. You know, did you find a lot of times that you were, really wanting to push things, even though you may have known it wasn't the best idea to do? Were you really anxious to say, like, oh, well, I did, you know, 3 miles yesterday, I can probably do 6 to 8, you know, tomorrow and start racing again?
Right. Well, I was the poster child for stupidity in there, because I did the advice, and there's nothing in the book exactly on returning to running, because the manuscript was actually due in January. So then I kind of led up to the surgery. But after the surgery, the surgeon was, you know, wait 4 to 6 weeks before you try to run again. Well, of course, being a runner, and you're looking for that piece of advice that may be a little bit different and give you the green light a little bit earlier. So, you know, talking to others and reading articles and others' experience, I saw that, you know, some people came back after, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. So at 4 weeks, I began running again, and to display my quote-unquote nuts ability is that it was too much too soon. So even though I started back up in February, I had to take a few weeks off. But when I resumed really for good in March, it comes back fast. It's amazing how quickly, without pushing it too much. And I think there's been some recent literature talking about the 10% rule, which was always the philosophy that you shouldn't increase your mileage more than 10% per week. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily true, and I didn't adhere to that. I just kind of worked my way up, just listening to my body more. And I had no knee pain. I was very successful in being able to come back, and probably by late spring, I was back up to running 60 to 70 miles a week with no problem. And, you know, knock on wood, things are still good right now. But you learn things. And there's a section in the book that also discusses approaches to, you know, in a humorous way, ways that I've learned to maintain your ability to be on the road, and the little things that you have to do, be it stretching or using an apparatus like the stick, to keep your ability to get out there every day, or however many days you'd like to be out there, and to avoid those injuries.
Yeah.
Not to interrupt, but I mentioned the stick, and my philosophy a little bit towards running is similar to something Leonardo da Vinci said at one point, which is that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. In other words, as you know, we get sometimes too bogged down in the nuances of things and realize that sometimes the simplest approach to something, be it training or recovery, is actually the most successful. And I battled hamstring and calf muscle pulls when I was in my early 40s to mid 40s. And finally, you know, I was one of those people that had, not to sound like an infomercial to the stick, but the foam roller stick. It's as simple as that apparatus may be. It is extremely successful in eliminating pulled muscles and keeping your muscles, from creating fibrous scar tissue, at least with the stick or a foam roller, being able to make those more pliable. And I've had no muscle pulls in about 10 years, and I attribute it to daily use of the stick. And it's those types of simple lessons that you learn over time that if you implement, we can avoid injury. And everybody, you know, my friends that don't run say to me now, well, don't you know that you're running the risk of becoming injured again? If you're running that much after knee surgery, it's inevitable that you're going to get injured. And I said, well, you know, it's not. It's not if you implement the things that will hopefully keep you, you know, on the roads and healthy. And there is a way, but you just got to do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally agree with you there. Sometimes it's really the simplest things that can make the biggest difference. But actually, I want to dig a little bit deeper into kind of the topic you're talking about, doing those little things to keep yourself healthy, the stretching, the foam roller, the stick, those types of things. One of my favorite chapters was the chapter that you wrote about where you tried to basically follow the protocol of, all the, I guess I should say, optimal practices that literature prescribes in terms of getting in strength works, dynamic stretching, ice bathing, eating right, doing all those little things. You talked a lot about in that chapter about how you tried it for a day and basically spent from, sun up to sunset, training and doing things related to training. Talk about how you balance that now, because obviously you experimented with it and saw what worked and what didn't work. But how do you balance things now, and how does that influence your running?
Sure. And that is actually one of my favorite chapters of the book, because it's developed from, I obviously subscribe to a lot of the running magazines and read a lot online on running. And, every magazine that you would receive would have some different approach to maximizing your running, increasing speed or your stamina or whatnot, from pre-workout warm-ups and what you should eat and post-recovery and everything and strength training. And it was dawning on me that if, you implemented everything you were advised to do, that, you almost wouldn't even have time to run. So it was kind of a humorous look at things in that chapter, as you're right, implementing everything I did for an entire day left me little time to do anything else. But you realize, to some degree, not to keep quoting people, but those that may recall the very philosophical and very good writer on running, George Sheehan, the late George Sheehan, his approach was simply that, we're all experiments of one. So you have to find out what works best for you. What may work for me, may not work for you. You have the barefoot runners now, which would not necessarily work for me. Or the minimalist shoes, I've experimented with all those types of things, but you have to experiment and see what helps you the best. And it's from something as simple as stretching, which of your muscles or whether it's your back or your hamstrings or whatnot, provides the most discomfort to your potential for injury. And my stretching routine is simply 10 to 15 minutes a day of 5 to 6 or 7 stretches that really work for me that I've tried over the years, and implementing them has eliminated any back pain and things of that nature. So it's a lot of experimentation, because obviously with this humorous chapter that you referenced, you can't do everything. And there are people that can, when I was in my 20s in college and in graduate school, I could wake up at 5 o'clock and be on the road running by 5:30 without coffee. these days, I gotta have my coffee. It takes me you know, if I'm meeting my running buddies at 5:30, I'm up at 4:30 because to get out the door, it just takes me longer. But those are, I'm just saying that you have to figure out what works best for you. And some people can still come to a race, you know, 15 minutes ahead of time and be able to cruise in that first mile as fast as they want to. And others really need a long warm up. But we're all experiments of one, which always amuses me when elite runners present their different training philosophies as gospel. It is to them. It may be successful to you, but to another, it may not be. And so, you know, this chapter in the book and some other lessons in the book try to illustrate that you just got to experiment a lot and try and figure out what works best for you. And one thing I will say that has worked for me, although the minimalist, you know, the real minimalist shoe was, I didn't enjoy as much as working on my form. As everyone knows, you know, there's a debate in the running world of heel striking versus midfoot versus forefoot. And I have found that if I concentrate more on a midfoot landing, problems and issues with injuries that or little nicks, as I call them, that would crop up from time to time. And I do think that changing running form can assist with that. But there's plenty of people, you know, there's a chapter in the book on running form, and there's plenty of people, Bill Rogers being one of them, who was one of our most successful American marathoners, as well as Joan Benoit Samuelson, who was, you know, if you watch some of her video, she was predominantly, at least with one leg, a significant heel striker.
Right.
And you know what? It's successful. It was obviously incredibly successful for her. So it's, you know, we're all experiments of one, and you figure out what works best for you.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic point. And, you know, obviously I deal with that question a lot. You know, I'll get either client questions or emails, you know, about, you know, what's the best way to do this, or should I do this? And, you know, should I change my form this way? You know, how does pose running work? And, you know, all those different types of things. And you're so right. You know, it's so individual to different people. You know, like you said, I've experimented with the minimalist running myself. And while I'm a believer in the science and what people are trying to do, and I understand it, it just, for me, it's a difficult process just because of the way my running form is, the way I run. And you're right. I think actually when you said about stretching, that's very true too. Like, I know there's the big, you know, not a lot of people like to do the static stretching anymore, or find that they said it makes it worse or doesn't actually help. But you know what, for me, nothing makes me feel better, you know, or when I wake up in the morning and I have to go run, you know, nothing feels better than a good static stretch. You know, even I do some of the dynamic stretching because I know it's supposed to be better for me. But still, nothing quite loosens up my hamstrings and calves like a good static stretch. So for me, it just kind of works, even if the science and, you know, the literature are telling me no. So I think it's a great, I think that's a great lesson for people to learn, that, you know, you need to always be experimenting with yourself and the things that you do to make sure that it's actually working for you and something that that can actually benefit you in the long run.
Right. I mean, you're right. And today with the internet and everybody posting various things on message boards and seeking answers to questions that really apply to them, and people trying to offer advice. Well, the fact is, you know, it's no different than pre-race nutrition.
Right.
You say I'm running my first marathon in a week. You know, really, what should I have for breakfast if the race starts at 8 o'clock, and et cetera, et cetera. But you know what, by that point, if you haven't experimented and figured out what your body can take, how quickly it can assimilate it and digest it, and what works for you, then it's a little late in the ball game. And it's similarly with people trying to offer advice to you. I know with myself, if I can't remember who the runner was, but they were asking an elite runner what she had eaten over the course of the 24 hours prior to a marathon, and especially the 4 hours before the marathon began. And I'm reading it, and I'm thinking, if I ate half of what she ate, I would come to the starting line feeling, you know, like a sumo, like a wrestler. I would not be able to. I'd feel bloated. I'd be, and especially what she ate that morning, I mean, I wouldn't have been digested by the time I hit the starting line. And so, again, it gets back to that simple philosophy that experimenting, we're experiments of one.
Yeah, no, that's very funny, because, you know, as somebody, we publish a lot of articles each week, and you know, one of the things that people are always asking is, you know, what do you guys do for training? You know, I should say you guys, you know, what do elite runners do for training? What do you guys eat before races and stuff like that? And I personally don't write any articles about what I ate while I was training because it would disgust people. You know, I can remember waking up when I was running for the Hansons. I remember waking up after a nap and eating a whole entire box of Cocoa Puffs. You know, because A, I was starving, and B, you know, and I still had dinner after that and everything. And but you know, if I told people that they were training for the marathon, like, oh yeah, it's okay if you finish off a box of, you know, Cocoa Puffs, you know, they would think I was crazy. But you're right, you know, but for me that worked, and obviously it was my metabolism is extremely fast, and I was running a lot of miles. But you're right, everybody kind of needs to find out what works for them. I guess actually similar story with the marathon. You know, I trained with Clint Viren, who is a very good marathoner, qualified for 3 Olympic trials. And he, the stuff that he ate before and during a marathon, I can't even eat without running. In terms of the total number of his caffeine intake is ridiculous. And just some of the stuff, and it's funny, but it's so worked for him, you know, for he had it nailed down and it was like perfect for him. But I would throw up if I ate it just sitting, you know, at the dinner table. So, you're right. Totally, experiments of one. So I guess on a similar topic, you know, again, looking at the book, you know, a lot of, kind of lessons hidden in humorous stories. Tell me about some of the most important lessons that you've learned, over the years as a runner. You know, yeah, obviously you have a lot of experience. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, some of them I may have touched upon previously. There is a chapter, let me see if I can find it, in the book that does offer lessons that I've learned along the way. One of them I alluded to about running through injuries and things of that nature. You know, one of them I do talk about, because especially with the second running boom, which has added so many races and so many huge marathons and so many people running, but a lot of them, it's a different philosophy than, say, back in the 70s and 80s, where people trained to run the best time possible. Now it's more, a lot of people do it for the social event that it's become, and a means of entertainment, and getting to the finish line is more important than necessarily how long it took them to get there. And for, you know, quite honestly, for a time I had difficulty with that philosophy, but now accept it and recognize that, you know, these people are running and that's a good thing, and they can take what they want to, and it doesn't necessarily have to be what I feel they should be taking from it or from what I want to take from it. But there is a chapter in the book that does touch upon certain, you know, things that I've learned along the way. And one of them, getting back to pace, is that what I say here is, let me see if I can find it here, a starting gun and a race bib do not miraculously produce untapped speed. The same modest pace every day equals running at the same modest pace during a race, which equals finishing in the same modest time. In other words, if you're interested in running fast, then you're going to have to put in the time and effort, obviously, within your training to be able to run fast. The fact that you show up at the starting line and the gun goes off and you have the adrenaline, well, that may take you through the first half mile at a faster speed than you're used to running, but, you know, as far as your mile per pace throughout that race, it's going to be consistent with what you were doing in training. Mm-hmm. So what I'm, you know, in a long-winded way, what I'm getting at is you've got to put in the time and effort within your training to work at your speed if you're interested in running a faster pace. And one of the things that I've always had difficulty with, and I still do have difficulty with, and you see it, especially I saw it, even evidenced in following my son's high school cross country career, where the coach would inevitably, after every meet, you know, send out in an email the paces that the runners ran per mile in the 5K race, and 99.9% of the time, even the best runners on the team, you know, their first mile was far and away faster than any mile in the rest of the race. And it's just so difficult for runners, even at, you know, my age or that age back in high school, to tone it in, to reel back that first mile and don't get caught up in the adrenaline of the race as much, so that you're going out, you know, 30 seconds faster than you really should be. One of the lessons I have there, short and sweet as it is, if you go out too fast, you'll come back too slow. And that's so true. There's, if I recall right, there's not been a world record, I can't remember beyond what distance, but
beyond 1500 meters.
You know where I'm going, where the runner that set the world record failed to run a negative split. In other words, always in with those world records, the second half of their race was faster than the first half of their race, because they knew what race pace is and how not to go out too fast. And I still struggle with this to this day, because everybody thinks, okay, you know, I'll let the adrenaline of the race take me out through the first mile or whatever, feeling so confident. Oh my God, I banked time. Well, you cannot bank time. What your race pace should be, you're going to feel it that last mile, or depending on the length of the race, that last half of the race, where you're going to be running slow. It's just inevitable. It's that you're going to be running slower than you desire to be running. So, you know, that's obviously a simple lesson, but some of the other ones is...
Those are actually, before you continue, because those are really two awesome lessons that I think I want to expound on a little bit more. Actually going back to the original lesson in terms of, you know, needing to work hard, I also think, or I should say, that if you, you know, if you only train at a certain pace during training, you know, you don't expect to do it, something miraculous to happen on race day. I actually think that also applies to the taper process. And this is something that I learned from a coach that I trained under and trained with, or coached with, Scott Simmons. And his, you know, he had this real great ability to actually taper and really peak levels, peak athletes at the right time for championship races. And one of the things that he used to tell us and tell his athletes and the coaches is that, you know, one of the reasons that so many athletes have a hard time with the taper and then on race day is that they somehow expect it to feel good, or more importantly, expect themselves to be able to do something in the race that they haven't done in training. And to me, that really stuck with me, and it's actually formed a lot of how I train people now, is that, you know, if there's anything that we want to do on race day, then we need to do it in training. You know, obviously that applies to speed work and stuff, but it also applies to the mental training. If you're looking to do, going back to the pace, if you're looking to improve your ability to run that first mile at the correct pace, then you need to do a lot of training, and you struggle with that, then you need to do a lot of training to practice that sense of pace when you're fresh, when the adrenaline's high. Or for example, you know, if you want to be able to race, you know, I tell athletes that, you know, if they're running a 5K, for example, that at about a mile and a half, they want to put in a surge, because that's when the pace typically begins to slow down for most athletes. If you look at a 5K race, that's almost 1.5 miles is almost exactly where everybody starts to slow down. And I say, well, if you throw in a surge at that point, it really kind of prevents that slowdown. But you can't just do that, expect yourself to do that in a race without doing it in practice first. So I think that, anyway, I just wanted to expand on that, because I think it's a great point about, you know, if there's anything that you want to do on race day, you need to make sure that you do it in training. And that goes along with the pacing, the ability to pace yourself that first mile and not going out too fast. And I was laughing when you were saying that, because it's such a common issue that I deal with from the athletes that I coach, you know, looking at their splits, especially when they first start working with me. You know, I say, well, show me your last, you know, the last race, what were your splits? And, you know, that first mile is always off the charts fast, and, you know, it's an easy fix for most people. But anyway, I just wanted to expand on that. Keep going.
Let's see what else I have. You know, some of the general things that can apply to everybody is, what I found, we all have those voices in our head that are questioning, okay, do I want it? You know, as you're laying in bed, I'm a morning runner. So sometimes here in Michigan, the weather, having trained here, there is not always conducive to running outside in the wintertime. And there's plenty of times that you can hear the wind howling as you're laying in bed, and you question, oh my gosh, you know, am I going to get out there? And I've always found, and many people have appreciated this as well, that it's always better to have gone, no matter how quote-unquote bad, and it's hard to have a bad run per se, but no matter how difficult the weather may be, when you get back from that run, you feel a lot better than you would have had you stayed inside and laid in bed or whatever. I mean, just the, you know, the lesson being, don't always listen to those little voices in your head that may be telling you to roll over and shut off the alarm. It's always best simply to get outside and experience that. And I, you know, within that chapter, I do touch upon that, you know, getting back to the experiments of one, we're also those that race to see how fast they can race or finish a race, try to compete with yourself and not necessarily with others as much. And it's always a difficult thing to accept, perhaps poor races that you may have, where you just have to move on from there. And especially as those that enter the Masters age group, I'm now over 50 at 52, and I'm not going to run. Obviously, I know my PRs are many years behind me, and to some degree, it's inevitable that you're going to slow down a little bit each year if you're doing the same consistent training, and you have to be willing to accept, as I may have touched upon earlier, effort more than results, in the sense that if I can get to the finish line of a race and be content that I didn't leave anything out on the course, then my time to some degree is irrespective of how I should feel. I should be content with the knowledge that, you know, I gave it all here, I gave it all in training, and the results are what they are. Some days you're going to feel like a gazelle, and some days you're going to feel like an elephant. It's just the way it is. And so some of these lessons touch upon not being so hard on yourself. And some of the other lessons are, you know, sometimes, as I say here, it's difficult to predict at the beginning of a run how you'll feel during the middle of a run, as it is to predict what song will be number 32 on Billboard's top 100 of the 29. I mean, the likelihood, and I found this as I've gotten older, when I was younger, I could say, okay, on Tuesday I'm going to do a fartlek workout at, you know, 5:30 in the morning, and I could do it. And now, as I've gotten older, though I may plan my week as to when I'm going to do what, until I get out there, I don't know, you know, it's like a grab bag. I don't know exactly how I'm going to feel. And and you have to be easy on yourself, and especially with your training, to adjust. And you can even see that with elite runners, where they're interviewed and they may say, you know, I had a speed workout scheduled for Tuesday, but I was feeling overly tired, so we pushed it to Wednesday or whatnot. And so they really do listen to their body and let their body tell them, you know, whether they should back off or push full throttle. And I think that's something, as runners get older, that they have to appreciate, is that, you know, you may have a track workout scheduled for X day, but it may not happen, and don't be so hard on yourself if you're feeling exceptionally tired that day. It's better to come back on a day that you're going to be able to really generate the right training that you want, the results that you want from that speed workout, on a day that you have energy. And so I touch upon in that chapter just you know, being easy on yourself and pushing it on days that you feel you can push it, and days that you need to run slow. And there, you know, you may wind up, as you get older, taking 2 or 3 days of what they call recovery runs before you're able to come back with a speed workout. And some days you don't know what you're getting.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, words of wisdom are flowing right now from you. I think everybody's going to appreciate. Because I think that's so true. And for me, that's something that I've always noticed separates the kind of the elite, more advanced runners that I know, and some of the more beginner or less experienced runners, is that, you know, the elite runners are more apt to just listen to their body and not, you know, not stress if they miss a day because they just weren't feeling that great and they decide to push things off. Whereas less experienced runners will often push through and then get frustrated that they didn't feel good. Even though maybe they weren't even supposed to feel good, you know, for example, on a long run where you're, you know, running at marathon pace for a good portion of it, and you've had some hard training throughout the week, you know, sometimes those runs aren't supposed to feel good. And so it's not a, you know, nothing to be too stressed about if you're feeling a little tired. But I think that's great advice. So before we give away all the secrets in the book, we'll actually cut the interview here, but I want to let people know how they can purchase the most recent book, I Run, Therefore I Am Still Nuts. Where can people go to purchase the book if they want to take a look?
Sure. It's available, obviously, on Amazon, as any book is, but it's, you should also find it in Barnes & Noble, and running stores are carrying it. Some may carry both books. There seems to be, for those that didn't read the first book, now seeing the second book, they're getting the first book. To, not that you need them both, but if you enjoy the second book, the first book is equally as timely as far as the subject matter in the first book. So they're pretty much available anywhere, and you know, the humorous running stories, anything that runners can relate with, whether, and that's what we found when the book first came out, is that from the elite runners to the back of the pack runners seem to enjoy it.
No, I definitely attest to that. Like I said, I read it early in my, I think it was college, I think I read it. And it was, I really, really enjoyed it. It's a great book. And now as I read it, I don't know, I guess probably 10 years later, you know, I still appreciate it, you know, even knowing more than I did back then. But I still appreciate it, and I still, now I can see the lessons a little bit more clearly, because that's what I'm looking for. But it's a fantastic book. It's a great read. You did a great job with this one, and I definitely recommend anybody listening to it to check out the book. Not only is it entertaining, it's very well done, lessons learned, and it's actually a great great Christmas gift if you're thinking of something to get some of your running friends, or maybe suggestions for your spouse. So anyway, Bob, I wanted to thank you for taking the time out of your day to talk to us, and the lessons that you shared are awesome, and I think everybody that listens today will really get a lot of benefit out of it, and hopefully they can apply some of them to their training and not make the same mistakes that you and I did.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Glad you enjoyed the books, and thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Thanks, Bob.